Hello out there, my friends. This is Tim Binal of binalofamerica.com with another edition of Binal of America Audio. It is 5/6/2006. Welcome back to Binal of America Audio. Glad to have you back. This week, it is Richard Dolan, part 2 of 2. If you checked out part 1 of 2, I'm sure you're dying to hear part 2. If you haven't checked it out yet, go back to Binal of America Audio. Download part 1. Listen to that. That'll catch you up to speed. For those of you that are up to speed, we're ready to rock and roll with Richard Dolan, part 2 of 2. The subject matter is early ufology. We're talking about that. We touch on MK Ultra and Ewan Cameron, the JFK assassination, and JFK and ufology in general. We talk about the Project Serpo story that's making the rounds in ufology today, and we also talk about the Charlie Sheen 9/11 story that broke like a few days before we taped the interview, so it was pretty topical at the time. Plus, Richard previews UFOs in the National Security State 2. That's coming soon, and Richard tells us about the process of writing the book and what's gone into it and what it's going to cover and when it may be coming out, and all the information you want to know about UFOs in the National Security State 2 is in this interview. So it's all that, plus more side tangents and things we go down. You know how we roll here on Binal of America Audio. I don't need to say much more about the preview. Let's talk about who Richard Dolan is. For those of you who are unaware of Richard Dolan, who didn't catch part one of two, who just completely jumped in here in the middle, here is his bio. Richard Dolan was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1962. He holds an MA in history from the University of Rochester and a BA in history from Alfred University. He earned a certificate in political theory from Oxford University and was a Rhodes Scholar finalist. Prior to his interest in anomalous phenomena, Dolan studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. In the year 2000, he published a 500-page study, UFOs in the National Security State. This is the first volume of a two-part historical narrative on the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 1941 to the present. Included are the records of more than 50 military bases relating to innumerable violations of sensitive airspace by unknown objects, demonstrating that the U.S. military has taken the topic of UFOs seriously. Dolan has published numerous articles on anomalous phenomena, science, and the intelligence community for UFO Magazine. In the year 2003, he helped found Phenomena, a magazine dedicated to leading-edge issues pertaining to science and society, and for which he continues to serve as senior editor and regular contributor. Dolan has appeared many times on television documentaries and radio programs on the theme of UFOs and government disclosure. He has been a featured speaker at numerous conferences, including the International UFO Congress, the International MUFON Symposium, the Aztec UFO Symposium, and others. His website is keyholepublishing.com. Let me spell that for you, www.keyholepublishing.com, K-E-Y-H-O-L-E, publishing.com. Check it out. That's his website. That's where you can find out more information about the book, UFOs in the National Security State. That's what we're talking about this week on Binal of America Audio. This interview was recorded on April 3rd, 2006. Richard Dolan, part 2 of 2 on Binal of America Audio.
So you think it may be possible that Hynek, he did the 180 on his point of view, but it could also be possible that he was sort of like an inside man at times, too?
I think it's possible. I do. It's also, things are not always so simple. I think it's very likely that Alan Hynek genuinely evolved in his beliefs on this.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that he, coldly, calculatingly said, okay, I'm going to have them believe as a believer. I don't think that that's how it works. I don't think anyone's so simplistic.
Yeah.
But what I do believe is that people find a way to convince themselves of things that they need to believe.
Yeah.
I once knew a person, for example, who was a sales rep for R.J. Reynolds Tobacco. This is in the early 90s. I remember chatting with this woman. Really intelligent, very funny person, good sense of humor. And me being who I was, I needle people. I'm an older brother. I've got younger sisters, so I grew up as someone who knows how to get under someone's skin. I mentioned in passing the name C. Everett Koop. Koop at the time was a Surgeon General who was all over the tobacco industry. They hated Koop. And I listened to this woman for 15 minutes. She had been so pleasant and charming and wonderful. Start going on this rant about Koop and then how No one's proven that cigarettes are bad for you, and it's just, they're just out to get us, and on and on and on. And I thought, well, how interesting. And this is a person, her paycheck is signed by R.J. Reynolds. She's found a way to convince herself of the belief system that she needs to believe in. Because everyone's got to wake up and be able to look at themselves in the mirror and respect who they are. If you can't do that, then you've got to find a way to do it.
Yeah.
And so I think in Hynek's case, it wouldn't surprise me in the least that he sort of allowed himself to believe in the reality of UFOs once he sort of put himself on the line publicly in front of the entire nation. So that's kind of my thoughts, my 2 cents on J. Allen Hynek.
Okay. Another little incident that sort of piqued my interest was there's an Air Force Scientific Advisory Board meeting, November 1965. The meeting's in Dallas. It's on the Colorado study that was about to start. And Jacques Vallée, I guess he was there, he says that he sort of intimated that it proved that the Air Force was more bungling than conspiracy. And you sort of ask the rhetorical question, could the Air Force really be still trying to figure out the UFO question? Maybe they're really that out of the loop?
Oh, yeah. I remember this. And, I think within the Air Force, I think I probably have a better appreciation of now than I did even when I wrote this book is the extreme nature of what we would call compartmentation,
yeah,
or compartmentalization. It's not that I wasn't aware of it at the time, but so then, in other words, something like the UFO topic, which is, and I've had people, very high level people, tell me this person to person, point blank, is extremely compartmented. I mean, one scientist who knows Bill Clinton and briefed Donald Rumsfeld, okay?
Yeah.
Said to me, in a one-on-one, I had a 4-hour meeting with this man, who told me about alien technology and bodies and a whole bit.
Oh, wow.
That's right. And he said to me, this is so compartmented, you would be astonished at the level of secrecy that is involved with this.
Yeah.
So going back to the 1960s, look, if you've got a public body that's investigating UFOs, let's say you're the Air Force and you got this Project Blue Book, the last thing you want are for these people to have access to genuine, actual information that's going to upset things. And so you want to feed them only the garbage, only the stuff that really doesn't matter. And so you give someone faulty information or inconsequential information year after year, yeah, they're going to think there's nothing to this, is all nonsense, and filled with crackpots. So I think that's what happened. So, I mean, Vallée's observation of these people, I mean, maybe he was just marveling at actually their incredible level of ignorance. I'm sure he was. But when you step back and look at the larger picture, this is not a case of bungling. And this is a big argument in the 1960s, and it carried on through the 70s and 80s, was it cover up or foul up? A lot of people said, no, you're making too much of a big thing out of this whole conspiracy aspect. These guys, this is a bigger topic than they can wrap their brains around, and they just don't know what to do with it. Institutionally, bureaucratically, they're not equipped to deal with it. I've never been persuaded by this argument. I think that, we need to give the U.S. intelligence community a little more credit. These are the guys who organized and fought the Second World War quite successfully, let us add. This is the community that developed the atomic bomb and did a lot of other very impressive things.
Yeah.
I think that, and that on top of that, based on the several hundred really good documents that we do have indicating serious interest in this topic, I don't think you can argue that they were not aware of how important this topic is. I think rather what you have to say is that important information was simply channeled in a very restricted way so that the public elements of it, were very safe and tame.
Yeah. Now, in the end of the book, you you make the case for Donald Kehoe being the most important UFO researcher ever. Why don't you sort of speak to that a little bit here?
Yeah, I guess that's, I still feel that way, too. Kehoe wrote, he didn't write the first UFO book in the United States, but he wrote one of the first books, and then he continued writing them through the 1950s. Donald Kehoe wrote five important books on the inside UFO situation. And we have to remember, he was a very well-connected man, and who was fed a lot of, turned out to be valid information on the UFO phenomenon. Kehoe was the first guy to write publicly about the Robertson Panel. He didn't call it by that name, but he knew within months that this kind of thing had taken place, and he wrote about it within less than a year in his next book. He wrote about a lot of UFO cases that only came out because his friends within the Air Force were able to get some of these cases declassified specifically for him to use.
Yeah.
And that was a real coup back in 1952 especially. And then, of course, he was the real, you know, figure of NICAP that pushed and pushed and pushed for UFO openness. I think without Kehoe's contributions in the early 50s, it would have taken much longer for the national security elements of the UFO phenomenon to really come out the way they did. A lot of people have talked about Edward Ruppelt's book in the mid-50s as being the single most important early book on UFOs. That may be true. Ruppelt's book is very important, but as I maintain that, you know, by the time Ruppelt wrote that book, Kehoe had already written three such books on UFOs and was actually more pointed than Ruppelt was. And so Kehoe really paved the way for other people to write about this. During the 1970s, after the Condon Committee had sort of put UFOs to sleep a little bit publicly, and the whole conspiracy thing sort of went away and became discredited for a little while, Kehoe was sort of relegated to the sidelines. But then once again, with the Freedom of Information Act era in the late 70s, all of that became revived when people realized, oh, wow, there really are a lot of really great UFO reports that have been hidden all these years. Kehoe was right. It was a vindication of him.
Yeah.
So, yes, I think Kehoe was a really important, the most important UFO researcher. And I do believe the day will come at some point in the future when lots of people recognize this. Donald Kehoe, I think should deserve to go down in history as a great American, as a great citizen of the world. He fought the good fight for a good 20-plus years, and I think was responsible for moving our knowledge significantly ahead. He wasn't the most scientific writer. He was a military guy who became a journalist, and his writing style didn't really lend itself to, you know, academic circles and that sort of thing. So, but his information, I think, has turned out to be very reliable overall.
Yeah. And one guy who sort of pops up throughout the book, he's not really affiliated with UFOs, but he freaked me out big time. Ewan Cameron.
Oh.
CIA mindbender of sorts. Tell me a little bit about this guy. I'm going to want to do more research.
Sure. Yeah, Cameron, he's not connected to the UFO controversy at all. And so you might ask, well, why even write about this guy? One thing I tried to do with the UFO controversy was to put it in a kind of proper place amid the history of other kinds of cover-ups. And, you know, you could say that was a good decision or a bad decision, but it was what I wanted to do at the time. And to show a reader that, in a sense, the cover-up of UFOs is really nothing unusual in terms of operating procedures. It's just how things are done. And, for example, I mentioned very briefly from time to time the story of Ewan Cameron. And the reason is that because Americans in the 1950s had no idea of this utterly horrific program that the CIA was running, which its main name was MKUltra. Now, if anyone has seen the Mel Gibson movie Conspiracy Theory, this is actually about MKUltra, and if you haven't seen it, it's kind of a cool flick. But basically what happened was in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, I guarantee you to this very day, but under different names, the attempt was made to find ways to harness the human soul, basically to control a human being in their mind. And so this is why the CIA monopolized the possession of LSD during the 1950s. I mean, if you wanted LSD, the only way you were going to get it in the 1950s was through the CIA.
Yes.
They had control over it. And the reason that they did was because they were trying to explore its use as a possible psychological weapon, like an interrogation tool, for example, as a truth serum, whatever. One of the other aspects of this effort in MKUltra was to fund the work of Ewan Cameron, who was quite arguably the most prominent psychiatrist in the world. He was a former president of the World Psychiatric Association. Okay, he was highly, decorated, but highly glorified in his profession. Worldwide, everyone knew Ewan Cameron. And his facilities were up in Canada, off American soil, which made him very convenient indeed. And what happened was he invented this Frankensteinian type of procedure, which he started to call psychic driving. And basically, he had this idea that if you came in, if you were a woman in menopause and were feeling kind of depressed, Cameron would say, "Hey, I know what I can do for you." Did you not? He had the sensory deprivation rooms. The nurses called it the zombie room, where you would go in and you'd be deprived of sensory input for extended periods of time. All the while, he was literally trying to erase your mind and fill it up with good stuff, you know, stuff that he wanted you to believe. That's why, hence, psychic driving home this. I mean, it's like out of Franz Kafka or out of some whacked out Soviet totalitarian fantasy.
Yeah.
Except that this was funded by the CIA covertly through one of their foundations. Human Ecology Society, something like that.
Yeah.
Society of Human Ecology. And this went on for years. And people had their minds irrevocably destroyed by Cameron's work. I mean, utterly horrific. And the thing about this is why I wrote about it. A, is that a lot of the very same agencies that were involved in UFO secrecy were involved in doing this. But B, we only learned about Cameron by a mere roll of the dice. And it was after the Freedom of Information Act era went into effect. One particular researcher, a man by the name of John Marks, was researching into this and stumbled across a couple of boxes that had not been destroyed. Financial records that led him onto the trail of MKUltra. When those records were all supposed to have been destroyed in 1973
yeah.
by the order of CIA Director Richard Helms. He told his guy in charge of the project, a man named Sidney Gottlieb, he said, Helms had just been fired by Nixon. He'd been given a month to clear out his desk. Helms was like, "Oh my God, we got to get rid of these records."
Yeah.
Told Gottlieb, "Destroy everything." Well, Gottlieb apparently did a good job, but not a perfect job, and a couple of files pertaining to MKUltra were remained, and that is how we learned about this program. Had John Marks not found those files, it is very probable, frankly, that all to this day that we would know of MKUltra would be allegation and rumor, unprovable, and so forth.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this is the nature of government secrecy. Richard Helms was also the man who said the first rule in keeping secrets is nothing on paper.
Yeah.
He knew what he talked about. And so the same kind of thing applies with UFO secrecy. And the MKUltra secret was maintained very, very well for about 30 years. You know, when you look at the nature of the whole program. And in fact, all that stuff came out and then went right back into the background. The books exist in university libraries. You can look it up. But what about current stuff that's going on regarding mind control? There's clearly a great deal that has been going on. These guys have not, you know, the world has not stood still, and research continues to be made. But try finding out about what the military is doing in this regard. It's, you know, not that easy.
Yeah.
So we're in a scary world. I'm very much an unabashed idealist. I feel like a throwback to the days when people believed in this concept of human dignity and freedom and privacy, incidentally.
Yeah.
And the right to know and to inquire into your government and to be a sovereign, you know, we the people. We are supposed to be the sovereign entities of this country. And I believe in that. And so, but what has been happening is the UFO cover-up has been one of the several knives in the back of that Republican system of government.
Yeah.
It's not the only knife in the back. There have been other things that have been really bad for us, too. But, you know, for all of the very brilliant people who are out there writing about the things that are wrong with our society, and I mean, they're being often right on, a lot of these people are really not getting the significance of the UFO cover-up. They just think it's all kind of fantasy, and they're totally wrong. Yeah. They're not appreciating this. People who talk about 9/11, for example, as a very probable inside job, I happen to agree with that. But these people also are really not willing to look at UFO cover-up as something that's significant. And in fact, they're afraid. They don't want to be tainted with, you know, the crazy, fringy people. When, in fact, the UFO cover-up is very significant. It has required the creation, or at least it's been assisted by the creation of a kind of secret government beyond the government.
Yeah.
I mean, think about something that's this important that is not allowed to be on the table of public discourse. And just stop and think about how significant that is. Something that is this big for more than 50 years that has been kept off the table. It's like this big elephant in your dining room and you're not allowed to talk about it. And so, and in particular, when one starts to realize that there's very probably an enormous amount of money that has gone into this research and development, money that some groups are making a fortune off of, and basically, you know, you might argue, allows them to control the dominant resources of the world.
Yeah.
And we, you know, poor slobs are just kind of here out of the loop watching, you know, TV and commercials and Jerry Springer and whatever else we watch. And I'm just kind of mind-numbed by a corporate-dominated media system.
Pretty much.
And that's what's happened to us. And so we've become a kind of, I mean, you know, years and years ago, people always assumed that fascism would look sort of like Hitler. Right? You know, you'd imagine the swastikas and the stormtroopers marching down your street.
Yeah.
And the leader who would say that he's the dictator. And, well, you know what? This isn't 1933. This isn't 1935. This is 2006, and fascism looks a little different.
Yeah.
Then, I think, and so Americans, in particular, do not know, I mean this, they do not know how to recognize fascism when it's staring them right in the face. And that's why what I call what we have an invisible fascism. Invisible because people can't see it, although they can feel it.
Yeah.
But they can't see it because, A, they often don't have the conceptual tools to understand what they're dealing with. Because, A, they don't have much of a liberal arts education. B, they don't have time to think. They work in 50-60-hour weeks doing whatever they do, and they come home, have a beer, watch TV, and that's it. But also it's invisible because major media absolutely will not discuss this because they are part of it. I mean, 95% of anything that you watch, see, or read is owned by one of five corporations in the world. And that doesn't mean they're all saying exactly the same thing, because they do understand the value of market segmentation. But news is very highly managed. Now think about this. If you want to manipulate mainstream news. It's a hell of a lot easier to do that when you only have 5 corporations to deal with as opposed to 200.
Exactly, yeah.
Which would have been the case 50 years ago. So it's actually easier now. And that includes internet. Yeah, there are still sources like yours and like other internet sources out there where there is still freedom for people to understand these issues. But increasingly, internet for people means AOL or their MSNBC homepage or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, corporate news, which is really no different than the news that you get when you watch, NBC on TV. So we've moved into... So our kind of fascism isn't 1933 fascism. It's a lot more sophisticated, no question about it, because our world is more sophisticated. Our technology is more sophisticated. Americans wouldn't just, sit on their asses if the president said, this is now a fascist state. I mean, who's going to be so stupid to do that? Yeah. Who's going to be so stupid to have this revolution in your face? No, they'll have the revolution silently. They'll make it so that it's invisible, and that is what has happened. That is exactly what has happened.
One aspect in the book that you sort of like purposely didn't get into much, and it's been beaten to death anyway in the esoteric community, so I think that was kind of what you said too in the book, was the JFK assassination. Is that so?
Oh, yeah.
I think maybe it's a ploy of the mainstream maybe to tie that in with the UFOs and make it look like everybody is just like, you find conspiracy under every rock. But what do you think the assassination of JFK, what effect do you think that had on ufology and the cover-up?
Ooh, that's a really good question. Well, first of all, I guess I would say that there is no question in my mind that JFK was assassinated in a conspiracy. I do not, absolutely do not believe that this was a case of a fellow named Lee Harvey Oswald doing this all by himself, or even quite possibly doing it at all. I think that there is excellent reason to believe that, in fact, the CIA was involved. I think there's very good reason to think that Cubans were involved, as Cubans who were involved with the Bay of Pigs seem to have been involved with the CIA to kill Kennedy. Mafia elements, certainly through Jack Ruby. Yes. And even, in fact, one thing I didn't fully appreciate a few years ago, but there are a number of future presidents who had very, very suspicious dealings with all of this, including a fellow by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yeah.
George Bush was in Dallas when Kennedy was killed. Isn't that interesting? George Bush knew the Cubans who were subpoenaed in the mid-70s for the JFK assassination by the House of Representatives. George Bush had an oil company, Zapata Oil, which was right off the coast of Cuba, one of its main places of business off the Cuban coast. George Bush was involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion as a support. He donated two boats, one of them was named the Barbara. So Bush knew these guys. There's a memo that surfaced in 1988 when Bush was vice president, a memo from J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI, in which Hoover stated, this is the day after, 2 days after Kennedy's assassination, he was visited by a George Bush of the CIA. And Hoover didn't give the details of this meeting, but he did mention that it was about the Kennedy assassination. Now, this is interesting because officially George Bush wasn't working for the CIA in 1963.
Yeah.
Officially, if you go into the, all the official records, he was an oil man. That was it. And only became director of the CIA in the mid-1970s. You know, just jumped into that position out of nothing.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, I think there's... It sure looks like Bush was CIA. Anyway, why would Bush be meeting with Hoover 2 days after the Kennedy assassination? Well, if you're CIA and you just killed the president, one thing you might want to do is find out who else might have the goods on us and who do we need to watch out for to find out what their position is.
Yeah.
And Hoover was a guy who would have some knowledge about this, and one thing you'd want to do is find out, is Hoover going to talk? And it sure looks to me that this is what Bush's mission was to do, is to go and up to J. Edgar Hoover and find out, listen, are you going to play ball with us or not?
Yeah.
Anyway, I think the effect on, I mean, the Kennedy assassination, we all know, I mean, this was a very important moment in modern American history for so many reasons. It's not clear to me, even now, you know, what its exact relationship with the UFO field is. There are people who subscribe to the idea that, I mean, there are disputed documents right now that exist, one pertaining to the death of Marilyn Monroe, for example. I've got this document, and it looks, I've talked with Nick Redfern about this. He thinks it looks legitimate. A lot of people think it looks legitimate. It's a document that talked about wiretapping Marilyn Monroe and an FBI document, and Marilyn Monroe's discussions of the UFO topic based on her conversations with Jack Kennedy.
Yeah.
And the implication being that she was going to talk about this. And then the further implication, this memo was like a day or two before she died, I should have mentioned, in the summer of 1962. It certainly looks legitimate. Of course, no one, like a lot of these documents, is a bastard child. No one's claiming ownership over it. It just sort of leaked. So if that document's legitimate, that puts a definite spin on the Kennedy assassination, because, and then you think logically, Kennedy would certainly want to be briefed on UFOs. All U.S. presidents, it turns out, I mean, they all seem to have an interest in this topic. Certainly the recent ones have a significant interest. Not, I don't know about the current president, but Clinton had a strong interest. George Bush Sr. is kind of like Cheney in the sense he seems to have a lot of connection to it, but he's very tight-lipped about it. Reagan had an out-and-out big-time interest in it, as did Jimmy Carter. It's not unusual for a U.S. president to want to know about UFOs. And so one would assume that Kennedy, at some point in his presidency, might have been interested in finding out about this. And officially, I mean, there just aren't that many documents linking Kennedy to the UFO phenomenon. You have to go into the so-called Majestic documents, some of which I think could very well be legitimate, but they are not of definite authenticity, and so it's hard to know what to say about it.
Yeah. So do you think the assassination of Kennedy sort of helped to add like a chilling effect, at least for future presidents, that, you know, if it had anything to do with UFOs, or if, even if he entertained the thought that it was like, you know, we can get away with killing the president, so.
Yes, well, when you put it that way, I would say the answer is yeah, I think it did. I've got to assume these presidents, you know, they're not dumb, and they know the capabilities of the intelligence community that they inherit.
Yeah.
And I think they also, most of them seem to get an idea that they really have very limited control over that intelligence community, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you know, they all seem to want, there's reason to think that they all want a briefing on this, but at least from what various insiders allege, you know, not all presidents get all the information that they want. Even the president can often be deemed to be, you know, as one insider put it, mere curiosity on the part of the president isn't enough to warrant him to have a need to know.
Yeah.
And we have it on the statement of Stephen Greer, who did. You know, I mean, people have widely varying opinions about Greer. Some people absolutely hate Stephen Greer. Other people think he's wonderful. I've met Stephen Greer, and I've spoken to him a number of times. And I would say, overall, I'm very sympathetic to what Greer has been trying to do.
Yeah.
With some reservations, let me add. But Greer, in the early 1990s, did, in fact, organize a large number of briefings and meetings with high-level government officials to inform them about the UFO situation, and that's a fact, and he did do it.
Yeah.
And Greer did speak with a lot of high-level insiders. I mean, people very close to the president and vice president. And says that he was told a number of times that you know, that at one point, Greer said that Bill Clinton felt that if he was to push this matter any more on UFOs, that is, that his life would be in danger. Greer said the same thing about Jimmy Carter. Now, it's hard to know how reliable those sources are.
Yeah.
None of this can be confirmed, but, and there are people who just say, no, Stephen Greer's full of it, but I don't feel that. I think that Greer, I think to a large extent he's the real deal in that he's been able to talk with a lot of legitimate people who have been willing to talk to him about a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
But it's all unconfirmed.
Yeah.
All of it. All unconfirmed. And now, with the Bush White House, it's so bad. In the a couple of months within 9/11, Bush's people sneaked in an executive order that further, gave added numbers of years to declassification of former presidential documents, like the documents of George Bush Sr. and of the Reagan years in particular.
Yeah.
We're now given 20-year, 25-year exemptions before declassification. And that's important because the Reagan stuff was about to be declassified. And it was withheld from declassification. Importantly, a lot of the people in the old Reagan team were members of the Bush administration, like Colin Powell, for example,
yeah.
And Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld as well. So very self-serving, but also in the long run, it's going to be very damaging because we're going to have a hard time getting this information out,
yeah.
The stuff that we had really hoped. There had been a lot of Clinton stuff that was scheduled to be released in early 2006, and don't quote me on this, but it looks like this also has not been released.
Yeah.
I should check with Grant Cameron.
Yeah, we had him on. We had him on last November, and he was talking about that there was going to be a release in the beginning of the year, but I haven't heard about it yet.
Yeah, I'd like to ask him about that. He was actually, he's more on top of that than I am, but
yeah.
You know, Grant's had his own problems, as you, I'm sure, know. I mean, Grant,
oh, yeah.
Grant and I were scheduled to speak at the same conference in Los Angeles last September. I made it. Everyone else made it, but Grant didn't, because Grant wasn't able to get across the border, and he was stopped by Homeland Security in a very brusque, unfriendly way, but also, I mean, they opened up his computer, they just said, no, you're not allowed in, and really gave him no good reason other than Grant was asked, why are you going across the border? And unfortunately, he told the truth, which was, I'm going to speak at a conference. Are you getting paid for this conference, sir? You know, you have to realize, you speak at a UFO conference, they'll pay like $200, you know, $250. It's chump change, believe me. So he said, well, yes, I'm getting an honorarium, which is what it's often called, and the Homeland Security guy said, well, no, sir, don't go there. Honorariums are for professors, and you're not one.
Oh, man.
And said, you know, do you have a work visa? A work visa? No, of course he did not, and he was denied access to the entry into the U.S. At a time, by the way, when a number of other journalists just so happened to have been denied entrance into the United States, journalists whose politics put them at odds with the Bush administration.
Yeah.
So that's Grant. But anyway, Grant Cameron, if people are not aware, I recommend that they visit his site, as well as my site. My site is keyholepublishing.com. Grant's is presidentialufo.com.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent website.
Okay, now two current event things I wanted to ask you about. First of all, it's the talk of ufology right now, and that's this Serpo story. It seems like everybody has an opinion on it. I wanted to ask you what you thought about it. And just the idea in general of the government cutting a deal with the aliens of some sort. That's always been the rumor. Now it's the rumor that there was some kind of exchange program. But for
a long time
it was a rumor of allowed abductions for technology or something. And what do you think of this idea of the government cutting a deal with the aliens, and in general also this Serpo story that's now all of a sudden become big news?
Yeah, I'm familiar with this, certainly. I'm rather afraid of the Serpo story, and afraid that it's going to become this big tar baby.
Yeah.
That's really going to damage a lot of people. I don't know, I could be wrong. do I see it as impossible that there's some kind of exchange? I guess not. The Serpo material, I mean, everyone, I think, would agree it's very well written. It's presented in a very intelligent manner. I mean, the guy writing the Serpo material, Serpo, by the way, is the name of the planet where supposedly these humans were sent and lived. For me, there's very little that I can do with such a story other than report that the story is making the rounds, and I do intend to do it briefly. Now, there's the other part of it, which is the whole subterranean culture of the rumor, let's call it the rumor mill, of a deal that's been cut with aliens. Look, I would not rule this out. I mean, I know that is kind of a fringy thing, but there is what I call the land of leaks. There are a number of high-level people who have gone on the record to talk about a massive alien-based infrastructure, technological infrastructure, and maybe if you have me on the next time, we can get into this, because this is actually the stuff that has been monopolizing my mind for the last several years.
Yeah.
It's been a nice trip down memory lane for me to talk about my first book with you. I've been working on all the stuff to succeed that in my forthcoming book.
Yeah.
A big part of that is this, are these many, many, many stories from seemingly credible people about deep, deep black technology programs, the purpose of which is to study alien technology and indeed alien bodies. When you hear this one time, you think, that's okay, I can dismiss that. When you hear it two or three times, and four or five times, and then 10 and 15 times, and then many times from people who have very high access. I told you there's one scientist who's in his 60s, knows a couple of U.S. presidents, and met with Rumsfeld. This guy is a high-level scientist. He's famous, and said to me point blank, he knows for a fact. He said, I'm not speculating. I'm telling you as a scientist that at deep, deep, deep levels of our national security apparatus that we are in possession of alien technology. And this guy said at least one body that I personally know about.
Wow.
I've spoken to Edgar Mitchell, who walked on the moon. Edgar Mitchell says the same thing.
Yeah.
And he says this publicly. He said it to me privately as well. Talked about the nature of... He said his two key sources on this, one is a general with a number of stars, let's just say, and another is a person of even more elite stature, who Mitchell won't say who it is, but both independently confirmed to him the existence of such programs. The general, Mitchell said, was charged with overseeing deep black research and technology programs and stumbled onto this E.T., and reverse engineering program, apparently, and said, how come I'm not running this? This should be under my control, and knocked on enough doors and finally got the answer, sorry, General, you didn't have a need to know.
Yeah.
He had nothing else to do except complain to his friend Edgar Mitchell. There are many other seemingly, let's say, credible accounts from individuals. There's the story of former Lockheed Skunk Works CEO Ben Rich.
Yeah.
Ben Rich ran Skunk Works, probably the most cool, cutting-edge aerospace program in the world, at least that we know about. These are the guys who developed the U-2 aircraft. These are the guys who developed the SR-71 Blackbird and the Stealth Fighter. I mean, and a lot of other really neat things. Ben Rich did have an interest in UFOs. We know this for a fact. He has a couple of written statements that were done privately in the 1980s. There was a public speech he gave at UCLA School of Engineering in 1993. I know one attendee of that lecture I spoke to at length about this, and Rich said at the end of it, he was basically just giving a standard history of Skunk Works, and then ended it by saying, we now have the technology to take E.T. home. This is in 1993. Some people who who have absolutely no curiosity about anything in the world filed out of the room, a bunch of people hung around afterward and asked Rich a series of questions. And he said, yes, that's right. We have the technology to take E.T. home, and it won't take a lifetime to do it. I think what he meant was to travel, in other words, to start. He also said there are, you know, we really need to let this information out because the Cold War's over and it's a different situation. And he also said there are a number of people in the black who would like to see this stay secret. You know, the person who was there said Rich was, he didn't say E.T. or alien explicitly, but that it was also very obvious that this is what Ben Rich was talking about. And there are, I mean, I myself corresponded with a former high-level executive, very senior executive of Raytheon Aircraft Corporation, one of the main defense contractors, who also said to me, said, great book, young man, and then said, incidentally, I saw a couple of UFOs myself, two of which I believe were not ours. I wrote back to him, in my inimical way, I said, well, what is it with you aerospace executives? All you guys seem to see these UFOs and have an interest in it, and no one talks about it publicly. And he wrote back and said, that's basically right. We are, you know, we don't want to get into that publicly. Yeah. But that, you know, this guy was, let's just say, right at the top of Raytheon for a number of years, and said to me that, they don't want to, they're not going to risk their public reputation by talking about this. No way. And also, there's clearly classifications involved here. I mean, it's this information is, there are clearly various legal restrictions for people to just give up the information that they know.
Yeah.
So, in other words, I guess what I'm saying is, to kind of get in a roundabout way to answering your question, is there a deal with aliens? Well, what I'm very, very sure in asserting, let us not say with 100% certainty, but let's say with 95%+ certainty, is that there is a substantial program in place right now by a very human infrastructure to study alien technology. Mm-hmm. Now, how did we get this technology? Is it all from crash retrievals? Or perhaps are there a couple of hand-me-downs? Are there a couple of trinkets that these other aliens maybe wanted us to have?
Yeah.
I think very possibly, yeah. I think very probably, yeah. This is me not being a historian. This is me being a, someone who's trying to speculate as reasonably as I can on the stuff that I do know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is my opinion question, right?
Right. I have to separate what I know from what I think it looks like. And I mean, the thing is, we only know a certain amount, and then we have to, as long as we make that distinction, I think we're okay. I mean, I never want to come off as saying I know that such and such is true.
Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable with other researchers who do not make that distinction.
Yeah.
There are a number, I'm not going to mention them by name, but they're out there. Some of them are very prominent in the, let's say, exopolitics disclosure field.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes my name gets associated with them, and I'm really not associated with any of those people. And the reason that I'm not, to be perfectly candid with you and anyone else who wants to put two and two together here, is I am not comfortable with people who are not careful with their sources and who jump to conclusions that may be true, but you've got to be careful how you present this stuff.
Exactly, yeah.
And I don't want to fall into that trap ever.
Yeah.